Okay, we have Eric Herring here today. Thank you for joining. I'm really excited to speak with you today about engineering growth and career pathing. So if you could you kind of briefly describe your career path?
Sure thing. So I came up as a software developer. I'm, 30 some odd years into my career, and I started very young as an early teenager. And I've been working in some aspect of technology ever since. There were a few awkward years in there where nobody would hire me. You can imagine, looking at a 17, 18-year-old kid and not really believing he could write your computer software. So I did get to do a couple of normal kid jobs, but they weren't long and they weren't very interesting. So I got back into software every opportunity I could. It even took me away from school the first time I tried to go to school because I was at the University of Texas at Arlington, and it's a fine commuter school. Or I don't know how it is these days, but at the time it was a fine commuter school, a fine engineering school. Turned out a lot of really great graduates, but the truth is most of the software people were from the defense contractors around Dallas, and they didn't actually know very much about writing software. I was already 5-6 years into my career working on a bunch of systems that were not mainframes, embedded systems, and Unix workstations and whatnot. And so, they were coming from the mainframe world. So we did not have a love connection. So I ended up dropping out of my first try at school because I decided they were all dumb and I would do better on my own, which is a very, 18, 19, 20-year-old thing to think. And in retrospect, I probably should have toughed it out, at least for the hardware engineering piece of it. I could have learned a lot if I just focused on the computer engineering side of it. But in any case, I dropped out and got various jobs. I was a campus consultant for Next. And then when I was about 20, early 20s, or sorry, early in the year when I was 20, I moved to Europe, to Denmark specifically, and did several things over there for the next decade, the whole of my 20s really. But one of the things I did is I ran the region for Next Computer as a sales engineer, system engineer. It was kind of a dual technology and sales role. So I wasn't the actual salesperson, but I had to make sure everything worked and explain how the computers worked and whatnot. And so that was my first taste of non-software writing technology work. And I got to do a bunch of stuff there related to, dealing with getting systems on the internet. I'm telling this a little out of order because I also got to play on the internet while it was still the NSFNet. If I'm not dating myself, I guess I am dating myself.
You had me at Next.
And so I've just been very fortunate. I got to get on the internet before there was an internet, and I started developing, but because I was involved with Next, I still remember the day we got, an envelope and there were like three flyers telling us various things about the next software update coming in Next Step, and two floppy disks. One of them had FrameMaker, I think, on it. For anybody who remembers that wonderful program, may even still exist, I don't know, but it was great on the Next as a desktop publishing platform, and this thing called worldwideweb.app. We put that in and fired it up, and we ran a server on one of the computers, and the worldwideweb.app was a server and a browser and an editor. Most people don't know that, but all the aspects existed when it first came out, when Tim Berners-Lee first shipped that, and it was a revelation. So I was on the internet before it was the internet, and I got to be on the web before it was the web, and I've been writing web applications in one form or another ever since, writing them, securing them, operating them. And so I guess as far as like how the time splits up, that was when I kind of first got into the operational side in a really heavy duty way, but also a little bit of a taste of management. So I was like a player coach, but I ran IT for the university library where I was going to school over in Denmark. Again, I dropped out. I did not finish. I got a bachelor's equivalent, but they didn't give bachelor's degrees. They only give master's degrees. At that time, they only gave master's degrees. So I didn't technically finish, and ran IT for the university library. And that involved having a couple of staff, you know, one of whom was my dear friend and business partner. So that was not like really having an employee, but technically he worked for me. And then another fellow who was the IT guy, he ran around with a screwdriver in his pocket and took care of putting network cards in and replacing 3Com network cards when they burned out and, you know, plugging coaxial cables into the back of machines and all that.
ArcNet, huh?
Yeah, it was old school. And so, you know, at that time, the library wanted to provide internet kiosks. And so, you know, we wrote a bunch of software to firewall off NT4 workstations so that you could only use the browser and not escape to any of the other programs. And, you know, you could print and browse, and that was what you could do. So we wrote a bunch of software to make that happen. And then we deployed the computers. We actually built the computers out of components for reasons I won't go into. It was just a smarter decision given the state of the supply chain in Denmark at the time. And so I got to deal with security. I got to deal with deployment. I got to deal with the politics of getting things onto the internet because that changed the nature of the agreement we had. You know, and shortly after that, I got to play in the first Danish Internet Exchange, which was an IXP, you know, very, very much like an IXP over here, but it was the first one in Scandinavia, I believe. I think Denmark led the way on that. And then later Sweden had one and Norway had one. But anyhow, that was kind of my first bite at the management apple. And from there, I went and did a little bit of management consulting, which for me was mostly teaching, which I loved. And that'll be, you know, that'll be a theme in this. You'll hear me coming back to it since we're talking about growth of engineering staff. And so I love the teaching. Believe it or not, I was a Microsoft certified professional, and I was teaching people how to use the directory services and how to deploy NT4 and all sorts of stuff like that. I have no idea what possessed me, but it was super fun. And somewhere in there, 1996, maybe 1995, we also ran a class at the People's University, which is, you know, kind of like adult continuing education in Denmark. And we taught normal people how the internet actually worked. You know, we taught them how sendmail worked, and we did it by giving them a pile of papers, and each piece of paper was a piece of an email message or a piece of an email message. And we all stood up and they like ran around. They were each a sendmail node, and they ran around delivering the mail, you know, that kind of thing. And then we ate a bunch of pizza and drank a bunch of beer. And then we, you know, we taught them how compilers worked, and we taught them how Telnet worked. And when we were done, a bunch of completely ordinary civilian non-technology people actually understood how the internet worked. At the time, we thought that was important, that people understood how it worked. So then I moved back to the States when I, you know, just before I was 30, spent about 6 seconds in a couple of programming jobs, and then coincidentally was sitting in a car in Hollywood, California. My wife was interviewing at this little interactive company, you know, 40 people, something like that, to be a producer. She was also in the tech industry. And, you know, 3 or 4 people came running out of the building and just accosted me in the car and said, "Your wife says you're a chief technology officer." and I thought about that for about 3 seconds, and I said, "Why, in fact, that is true. What can I help you with?" And that's how I got started, you know, having no business leading anyone, honestly, at that time. That's how I got started. And this is 1998. And we went from zero technology employees. I was the first technical employee at this interactive agency. They had typically been farming that out to third parties. And I became the first employee. And I think within 18 months, we had hired 100 people in one of the most brutal talent markets, you know, to date. Even counting today, it was pretty brutal back then, fighting for talent. And so that was a formative experience. And the best thing I can say about my tenure there and the next couple of jobs I had is that some of the people who worked for me will still speak to me. They don't all cross the street when they see me coming.
Okay.
You know, and I'm, you know, tongue in cheek a little bit, but I also mean it. I mean, I think there's a lot to be said for having somebody teach you how to do management and certainly how to do executive management. And, you know, I didn't. I just had a frying pan to jump into. And when that got too hot, I jumped into the fire.
Right. kind of reminds me of the Richard Branson story where everything that ever came to him in his early career was stuff he'd never done. And he'd always be like, yep, let me get that for you. And then he'd go figure it out, yeah. You know?
Yeah, no, it's 100% true. And I read Losing My Virginity many years later. And I had no idea. I was just, you know, I was in possession of unearned confidence and the burning desire not to let anybody down. Yeah. And so, you know, I did it. And it was mostly good. We did a bunch of good work. We grew the company significantly. We ended up, you know, having a small event, nothing like Razorfish or Sapient or anything like that, but a small event. And, you know, I'm still dear friends with the fellow who hired me, and many of the people I worked with through that and the next few jobs. And so, you know, I'm going to call it a win, but there's a big part of me that wishes I had gone to, you know, management college at GE or something like that. Before diving into that, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do. But those technical chops, I'm sure, helped you be a engineer's manager, if you will. Right.
I mean, I certainly tried. I tell people that I'm most comfortable, you know, when I address this question, I tell people I'm most comfortable leading from a place of knowledge. And that works for me because then we're talking about the thing, right? We're not talking about people. We're talking about working the problem, and we're working the problem in front of us, and we're working it together. And, you know, I like to tell myself, I hope it's also true, but I like to tell myself that engineers do respect that.
Yep.
So, you know, it's not unusual even today that I have some perspectives they don't have because the way I came up, you know, like when I started connecting computers to the internet, we were still using a hosts file, right? DNS hadn't even been deployed. You know, it was shortly thereafter, but that was like a big change. You know, I was standing in the back of the room. I like to say when they rebooted the internet for the Morris the Morris worm. You know, I was standing in the back of the room when they took University of Texas at Arlington offline.
Wow.
You know, I didn't do anything. I was just standing there, but it was interesting, right? That was like one of the last times you could actually turn the whole internet off. And so, you know, I got to see a bunch of that stuff, and, you know, I worked with C, and Objective-C and other languages like that, you know, very low level language assembly very early on. Actually my very first job was because, the guy who was programming the typesetter, like machine language on a custom Fairchild Semiconductor chip. He was updating some of the firmware because it was out of support, or the owner of the typesetting machine didn't want to pay for support. I'm actually not even clear why this was not being done by people at the typesetting company, the Veritype, I think it was. But that was my first real job. I was like, I can do that. And he's like, sure, kid, if you can make it do blah, 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 you know, I think it was a kerning issue or something. If you can make it do that, I'll pay you.
I'm pretty sure there's a computer file video about this, by the way.
Really?
Yep. They wrote some kind of cross compiler so they didn't have to pay for updates or support. I'm happy to have put it in the link along with this podcast, and I'll send it to you. I just watched it about a month ago.
No, I want to see that.
It was brilliant. Yeah, they actually kind of cross-compiled stuff, whether, I don't know if they extracted some of it off of firmware or whatnot, but it's really cool.
That's interesting. Yeah, and, you know, but I have a deep, you know, this will probably be a reference lost on some people, but I have a deep personal connection with Cameron from Halt and Catch Fire. I don't know if you saw that show. But, you know, she was the one sitting in the room, as some of my friends were back in the day, in the show. She was the one sitting in the room reverse engineering the IBM BIOS.
Cool.
The company wasn't called K-Pro or Compaq, but that's what it was, right? It was in Texas, and it was clearly meant to be K-Pro or Compaq or one of those, probably K-Pro, honestly, given the timing. And so I just always, since I saw that show, it's like so evocative of that time. Mm-hmm. And the things we used to do, you know, and now we're, you know, now we're deploying hundreds of thousands of lines of code to return a simple web response, and nobody thinks anything of it.
Right. Yeah, I can tell you have those old school roots. Yep.
Yeah. I'll also get off my lawn, right?
Yeah, right. So was it Vim or Emacs, or should I say VI or Emacs?
Emacs, man, all the way.
Okay. Excellent.
You want to hear an Emacs story?
Definitely.
Well, so I spent some time during all of that early years when I was the campus consultant for Next. I got a second job as a system administrator for the Automation and Robotics Research Institute at the University of Texas at Arlington. And, you know, we had cutting edge stuff in this place. We had a Mako computing surface, I believe it was, which was a Japanese supercomputer, which had less horsepower than the iPhone I'm holding in my hand right now. But it was amazing. And we had a two-dimensional slider that could balance a steel pole. You just put the steel pole on it and it would balance it. That was state of the art for, you know, feedback control systems and whatnot. But we had a bunch of symbolic Lisp machines. And we had this one guy, I probably shouldn't mention him by name. He's still active, crazily. He was a crazy hacker. And he loved the symbolic Lisp machines. I can't remember what it was, but they made a change. I don't know if it was a routing change. Anyway, it was a change that broke the TCP/IP stack. And he did not want to wait for symbolics to release a patch. And so while I was standing there, he like hit this wacky key combination, dropped into an Emacs, you know, editing the kernel code right there, and just started hacking away at the kernel Lisp on the symbolic Lisp machine. And like 30 minutes later, he did another wacky key combination and the machine started back up and was back on the internet.
Wow.
And ever since then, I've had an irrational fondness for Emacs and for Lisp.
Nice. Have you ever read the book, The Cuckoo's Egg by Clifford Stoll?
Love that. Cliff is a great guy. Have you met him?
No, I wish to someday.
Yeah, no, you should. He's crazy. He's crazy as a cuckoo.
I can imagine.
But he's terrific. And I love that book. I love that book.
It's in my top five for sure.
Yeah.
Cool. Go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say that book and Fire in the Valley is a book everyone should read.
Definitely. If I could add one more, Godel, Escher, and Bach is up there.
yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So I guess between, you know, your time at the Interactive Agency as your first chief technology officer, what was it like up until your time now at Vinyl? What was in the middle there?
So from the agency, I went on and did a couple of, you know, more traditional company roles, product companies. So I went from there to a company that was building a learning management system, actually a very specific learning management system for compliance education for large corporations. Some people listening to this will, if it gets wide enough distribution, we'll be able to guess who that is. Actually, they can just go look at my LinkedIn. I don't know why I'm being precious about the names. It's a company called LRN. And I ran engineering there for a little while. That was the place, honestly, where I learned the most about what I cared about. I actually had forgotten. Thank you for asking. So I had forgotten there's like a whole story there that bears on the topic you're interested in, because I left that company because I would not let the CEO abuse my people. And I did not quit in protest. My boss, who was amazing, he was the CTO. I was actually the VP of engineering. He was amazing. He took me for a walk in Westwood. We were in one of the big mirrored building that looks like a Spanish galleon in Westwood. I think it's still there. And he took me for a walk, and we ended up in the sculpture garden at UCLA. And he finally got to the point after we talked about, you know, everything else. And he said, you know, I don't like to surprise people, you know, and I don't think I've ever surprised you. I said, no, you never have. And he said, well, I'm going to today, and I'm sorry about that. This is your last day. And I said, okay. You know, I'm not super sad to be leaving. You know, nobody likes to get fired, but can you tell me why? And he said, the CEO, he said, he can't take you talking back to him in management meetings. And he thinks that you're too soft on your people. And I said, you know what? I'm cool with that. That is not a problem. Talk to me, you know, talk to me about the mechanics of leaving. And, you know, he took care of me, which was nice. And that's also where I learned about taking care of people and how, you know, when you're going into a job, you should also ask for things that let you tell the truth and leave a job, especially as an executive. Because not everybody has the luxury, you know, there's this whole Twitter war going on right now about how everybody should quit GitHub and because they work with ICE, and how everybody should quit this company and that company because they're doing things people don't agree with, you know, and it'd be nice if we all were in, you know, if we all were in a movie and quitting your job had no consequences, but a lot of people can't do that. Right. And so especially as an executive reporting to the CEO or reporting to the board, you've got to be careful to make sure you construct an agreement going in, an employment agreement going in that lets you tell the truth and lets you protect your people. And so I learned that in that job. And so from there, well, so then there was a detour because that was on September 1st, 2001. And, you know, as most people probably know, 10 days later, two planes flew into the World Trade Center. And I was, you know, my dad called me from Texas after the first one hit, and he said, get up, turn the TV on. And we sat there and watched the second one fly into the building. And I made a, you know, I had just started my, you know, I hadn't even really started my job search. I was like, I've got 2 months of severance. I'm cool. and at that moment I decided that, you know, somebody had to secure, you know, secure the nation, and I might as well help. And so I took a sharp kind of right turn away from CTOing and into chief security officering. Went and did a stint at Toyota, and then at a publicly traded insurance company where I was, my title was not chief security officer, but I was the senior security person on the management committee and all that. If I'd stayed longer, my title would have been chief security officer. And I realized that I didn't love that for a lot of reasons, mostly because the job of a chief security officer is to say no. And I like building things. I'm a builder, right? I'm an engineer. Mm-hmm. I like saying yes. That lasted for, you know, a while. I did one additional security role. Actually, in between those two, I did an additional security role, which was like a security architect role. So I was doing software engineering, but from a security perspective. After that, I started starting companies, or being an early employee of companies. And I, you know, did that two or three times, And, you know, we sold one of them somewhere in there. And somewhere about 5 years ago, I realized that, you know, swinging for the fences was not good for me. It wasn't good for my network, you know, because at this time I've got a whole bunch of people I can call, you know, people who, like I said, the people who don't cross the street when they see me coming, right? There's enough of those that like I bring them along with me when I can, when it makes sense. And I realized I was tired of bringing them into these early stage startups where the incentives were so wildly misaligned, the chance of success was so small, and where, you know, I was almost certainly being put in a position where I needed to ask them to take less than market compensation for stock that I was myself pretty sure was going to be worthless. Not because I had any inside knowledge, but because most of it's worthless, right? The statistic is worth zero.
Yeah, I hear you. I've got a wall of shame of certificates that are worth nothing, you know?
Yeah, no, exactly. And if you don't have a bird, what are you going to do with them? Yeah. And so that was when we decided to start Vinyl. And I started it with two people who had both worked for me once together. We had all been together immediately prior to Vinyl. And then they had each worked for me once before in other jobs. And now we're partners. We started Vinyl together. And that's been, you know, 5 years in, and we're doing great. We're solving important problems for, you know, companies that need our help and can pay their bills. and we're pretty happy about it. And so now it's all talent. It's all talent all the time. That's all that matters is getting the best people and keeping them happy, which is also, you know, relevant to the topic you're interested in.
Most definitely. So I guess real briefly, just talk about what Vinyl does and maybe the size of your engineering org.
Yeah, for sure. So we are a product development firm. We participate strategically and on implementation for, you know, clients that have important stuff they want to do, typically in highly regulated industries, like lending, you know, lending or any kind of fintech, really, financial technology, as well as medicine, health and wellness, and health insurance. We also have a significant presence in, which I guess is kind of where fintech and healthcare come together, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we focus on things that are going to move to, and we're a dev shop. Okay. So, you know, we don't out of hand say no to any good project, but if we have our druthers, we pick things that are going to move the needle for the experience of the person who is utilizing, you know, the end product, whether that's in the health insurance space, that's the person who is the insured person. You know, in the fintech space, it's the person who is, you know, taking the loan or using the financial product. And we like to be where the user experience comes together with the technology.
Yep. Okay, great. And how about your org? Maybe describe that a little bit.
Yeah. So we are at this point about 65 or 70 people. Most of those are engineers. We got a very little bit of support staff and some designer staff and some project management staff, but mostly engineers. We're about half in Boise, Idaho, and about half elsewhere. So about a quarter in Southern California, Southern Northern California, and about a quarter kind of spread out over the rest of the country. We are a good mix of kind of senior and mid-level people. I would say we're very light on junior people by design. We acquired a company in Boise. That's how we got our footprint there. And the people who worked there were excellent, you know, excellent people and, you know, hard workers and did their best, but they were significantly more junior than we even could have appreciated at the time. And so that was a whole challenge. We worked really hard to develop those people. And a couple of them are still with us. You know, they took well to that because, you know, development is not always comfortable if you're the one being developed.
It's true.
forced, you know, quote unquote, forced development, I should say. You know, I'm making the finger quotes, because nobody's an indentured servant or you know, nobody's required to stay someplace, right? But we told them if they were going to stay, they needed to do some stuff. And so some of them, you know, a couple of them are still with us. Most of them moved on. And, you know, I hope that they are, you know, hope they're doing well. They seem to, as I see them on LinkedIn every so often, they seem to be doing well. You know, and I told them, you know, the ones we had to part ways with, the ones we had to let go, you know, some of them left on their own because they didn't love the regime of training and development. And some of them we had to let go. And I told all of them the thing that I truly believe, which is, you know, this is great. This is what needs to happen next. You're going to be happier. You know, we're going to be happier. Everybody's going to be more productive. And look at, you know, jobs are short. You know, careers are long. Life is long. And, you know, I hope that, you know, once this doesn't sting anymore, you know, I hope we keep in touch. And I meant it. I meant it in every case because it is true. You know, I got a call from somebody I last worked with 10 years ago, just last week. And, you know, it boggles the mind, but he remembers me fondly and he wants me to help him with something. I'm going to help him, you know, because, you know, I remember him fondly, you know, and we did good work together. So let's do it again.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say, that's also hard though, right? I mean, coming from a place of kindness and generosity when you have to make payroll for 65 people can be tough, and you just have to remember to do it, and you have to make yourself do it, because sometimes it's easier not to be kind or not to be generous, and that's never the right move.
Yeah, absolutely. I have this saying that, you know, by the time someone's leaving, ideally there are no surprises. I mean, short of the surprise you had in the Rose Garden at UCLA, what I mean by that is, you know, by the time someone isn't cutting it, you've ideally had enough pips or sessions with them to show them the path to improvement. And you know, similarly, if you're doing enough one-on-ones with the whole team that they're in, people are telling you when someone's not cutting it, mm-hmm. and you already know too. So if they just bolt, it's not a surprise either. And I always say that it's really the surprises that we really don't want, right? It's like
100%,
you know,
100%. The last person that we had to let go. It was kind of hard because we really liked him. He was like a good social member of the team. You know what I mean? Right. And it was tough, but it was an easy conversation because, you know, I pulled him aside. I can't remember if we sat down or if we went for a walk. I often like walking with employees. I've been told I should just get a leash, which I take that in the most loving way possible. I hope they don't actually think I want to put them on a leash. You have to cut that part out.
Is your office in West Hollywood?
That would be funny. That would be very funny. I may get an office in West Hollywood just so I could do that. But I sat him down, I believe, and I said, "Hey, buddy, you know, you can't be happy here. Like, we've tried everything. It's not working. You know, what do you want to do?" And he just looked me right in the eye and he said, "I need to leave." And I said, "I think you do. Let's figure out how to make that easy for you." And we did, right? And that was that for me, like short of him becoming what we needed from that role, that was the best outcome.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is great. We're actually talking about growth from an interesting stance that I hadn't considered, which is, you know, coming from the lower end of the curve, you know, kind of how do you raise performance either up or out? But I'd actually like to sort of segue into, you know, what does it look like for folks that are excelling, like people who are, you know, they have a program. What kinds of things are you doing in your org to make sure that at least at an individual level, each person is always professionally improving?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a lot more fun conversation. So sorry, I took us to the other place. It was just a quirk of this particular this particular experience with vinyl, which you know was instructional for me. I learned a lot from it. But the other side of that is definitely a lot more fun.
And I'll tell you, I do three things. And I think I do them relatively well. You know, I hope in a blind survey, my employees would agree with me. but one thing is I do my very best to find good projects and to keep people moving from projects that have become, you know, muscle memory or that are not challenging them onto projects that will challenge them.
Yep.
And we're in the kind of company with lots of different clients where that's possible. And I love that about our company. I love it for that reason, right? Like there could be a business goodness in like a boring sameness, but from an engineering development perspective and the, you know, keeping people happy perspective, having a diversity of different projects.
Right, really. Right. Sorry to cut you off. No, I call that enrichment. You know, you go to a zoo and you see animals that are in this environment every day, and not to relate it to animals, but
no,
at a core sense, we're animals too, right? And they'll take the food for an elephant and they'll put it inside of a little ball, so they have to dig for it, and you know, they'll hide it over here one day and they'll put it over there the next day. And we're human animals too, and we need that enrichment, or else it's Groundhog Day, right?
No, 100%. I used to go to the Art Center, College of Design, graduate days, and I was one of the judges for several years running for when they would present their graduate program, their graduate, I guess that was their thesis. And it was fascinating. This one year, it was a young woman who worked with animal enrichment, and that's where I learned that they make blood balls for tigers, for all the big cats. They basically like take animal blood, whatever it is, chicken, whatever, and they pour it into water and they whisk it all up and freeze it into a ball. And so they give that ice ball of blood to the tigers and they just chase it around all day long and get so much exercise. It's heavy, like it's bowling ball sized, right? Maybe a little bigger than that even. And they lick it and they lick it because it tastes a little bit of blood. It smells like blood and they're like super excited by it. And that keeps them happy, you know? And the same thing is absolutely true for engineers. Again, I agree with you. You know, they're not animals, but they also are, you know, so am I, so are you.
Exactly.
That's an interesting analogy. I hadn't thought of that in a while, but that was like a big moment for me. It's like, sometimes you just need a blood ball.
Yeah. So, right. So let's say I'm an animal on your team. Okay.
Yeah.
What's that look like for me? What do your blood balls look like?
So besides projects, I have to admit, been slacking off the last 6 months because we've been super busy and everybody is pretty engaged, but we started off strong and we're going to get back to it because it's core to my belief about how the team needs to function, with quarterly personal development goals that we negotiate with each employee individually.
Yep.
And the quarterly professional development goals, there can be some personal development in there as well, but it's mostly professional development. And these core goals, we negotiate them. And here's the important thing. It's got to be something that is roughly relevant to our business,
right?
Slash to their, you know, professed path, whatever that happens to be. You know, I probably wouldn't say no, but I wouldn't think it was a super great idea for like a front end developer who was really deep in React to tell me they wanted to write an operating system kernel.
Yeah,
like, I'd probably try to gently steer them away from that. But the other thing is, there has to be some tangible proof at the end. And the point of the tangible proof is not to prove you did it. Like, I know people are going to do things. I trust people have done things they say they're going to do. The point is to share the knowledge, right? And I secretly hope that some of them, you know, get the bug to teach, you know, whether that's writing a blog post or doing a lunch and learn or whatever that is. The tangible demonstration of your learning is a very important component of that.
And absolutely.
And we did really good at that for, you know, quite a few quarters, and we are going to and need to get back to it because we've just had another little growth spurt, and it's a social norming thing as much as anything else. And people like it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that resonates a lot with me. It's hard for me not to jump in there through all of that, but I've been through the exact same experiences. It's like setting goals. It's like, it's great if you want to learn Mandarin, but those aren't aligned with the company. And you're right. You need to align the success for one. And then the second thing that really resonated there is you have to have a multiplier effect to the learning. And like you just said, we do that. It's lunch and learn today for SQL. It's lunch and learn for React versus Angular. You know, we're in a battle in our front end team of which one we're going to use. This is years ago, of course.
Yeah.
And blog posts too. And actually that ties into, well, I don't want to spoil it, but that ties into the next series I'm doing, which is how to put your ethos out in the wild. And this is a big part of it, is inspiring your engineers to write about something cool they're doing at work, because it ends up that the next two engineers or the next 10 that you get, they read your engineering blog site and they're like, man, that sounds like a cool place to work. Look at the stuff they're doing with Docker and with Kubernetes, or, you know, all the things. Right.
100%.
And so I'm right there with you. Cool. Didn't want to steal the thunder. So, I mean, that's all great. You know, growth, you know, the idea is that people are challenged outside of their comfort zone, and they have ideally a magnitude level growth in their time with you, which just means they're also there for a long time. And I'm sure you've seen it in plenty of your employees just starting here and then winding up there, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. And the third piece of it, which I think is probably equally important, and this is something I'm working on scaling right now. We're at this, you know, I'm sure you're familiar. We're right at that odd stage where, you know, revenue, number of people, all that good stuff kind of lines up to be a tremendous pain in the ass. Like, you get past it or you don't. We're at that place, right? And we're making great progress getting past it and getting to the next stage. You know, mostly because we've done it so many times before, so we're not surprised by any of it, I guess. We don't have any particular inside track, but we're not surprised by the challenges we're running into at this stage of growth. But we're trying to scale it, right? I need to find more people who are senior level people who love teaching and love nurturing. And we've got a couple. And so, you know, now I need to give them the tools and the time to give me that leverage. Because the third thing that I do is I make time with each of the engineers. And it's crazy, you know, and it's not because I'm magic. It's because paying attention to the things that people care about and interacting with them and sharing your knowledge is just an incredibly powerful bonding activity.
Absolutely. Like,
and so those are the three things that I find most beneficial to, you know, keep people in the saddle, A, and also to keep them developing.
Yeah, definitely. If it's any consolation, you know, in reaching out for this series, I had a great response rate. You know, people were responding within literally hours, and I'm talking like 5 a.m. Pacific time. People are replying back like, yes, I'm
That's
in.
That's awesome.
Right. But also I did notice from people who I know are seasoned and who've literally talked over beers or lunch about the same topic, they're not necessarily responding. And it's because growth, And for that matter, career pathing, which are kind of two sides of the same coin, it gets thrown out when you get busy. And sometimes you don't get that mojo back for a quarter or two. And I think something you said was really important, which is, you know, it's kind of easy as a thought leader and as a old school hacker engineer type to be like the ethos in your org. But as you're scaling, how do you have that permeate through the org as you're growing? And I'd say that you have to be careful in hiring, and you have to hire like-minded folks who are going to help nurture these goals with you, because engineering management directors, VPs of engineering, whatever size scale you are, they're going to have their own other set of goals. And you have to have people who are also aligned with you that, no, every person here is going to have quarterly, you know, KPIs and stretch goals, however you want to call it. And we're actually going to call it in, you know, that which is observed is respected in management. Yep. And if you're not looking every quarter and being honest with yourselves, the next quarter is going to suck, and then it's going to be, you know, off the table. I'd say I agree with you on the one-on-ones. In doing that with my staff, I did it up until about 50 or 60 engineers at my past company. And some of the best performers, the people who had the most growth, they're bringing their little black book to every one-on-one. And before we even start talking, they'll be like, for 2 minutes, they're quietly reading the notes from last time. And they're, right. you know, basically going over things that they're going to talk about. And then as we're talking, they're writing down stuff. And, you know, it's kind of like being like a CrossFit coach or whatever. It's you can take people to the box, but they have to put in the reps, right? And that's such an overused analogy. But
no, it's true. 100%.
Cool. So great. So I guess let's switch gears over to just career pathing, right? So,
sure.
You know, I think one of the resounding things that hit with us when we started our last company was, as a core executive group, we spent so much time on culture. And at the time, it almost seemed like we were just, like we'd have a 15-hour day and then spend three more on culture from like 6 p.m. to 9 or whatever it was. And it was just crazy at the time. But we like would bring in things like the Netflix manifesto and look at all kinds of other companies' culture. And something that stuck out for me is like, we want you to be successful, right? And, you know, if we don't have a place for you to move up into, we'll throw you a pizza party and give you a good pat on the back out the door. I'm paraphrasing, right?
Yeah, for sure.
But the reality is people's career path are going to go much longer than just working with you, as you said earlier. So as part of the one-on-ones and things like, you know, what are some of your philosophies there on moving people through that arc, and how do they lateral, you know, do some people go into management? You know, tell me about that.
Sure. So the first thing, I think it's important for everybody who's trying to manage people. I think it's important to realize that, you know, culture is not a thing that exists. It's a name we give to the thing that exists. And what I mean by that is that, you know, culture is very much just what you do every day. And so that means that when you take seriously looking at how other people do things and you try and incorporate the best of that into how you do things, that to me, and not to put too fine of a point on it, but this is an important point for managers, for the people who are working on the organization instead of working on the projects, right? That's acculturation, right?
Yep.
If you're not deciding what you're going to do every day in a way that promotes these shared values, you are probably not doing it right. If you let your culture be emergent, you might get something good, you might get something bad, but you're not going to get something planned. And there's an aspect of unplannedness no matter what, but you know, that should be the 20%, not the 80%.
Mm-hmm.
And so the other thing I'll say about that is I think everybody needs to remember to give themselves this extra degree of difficulty as you're trying to build a strong, you know, culture, a strong set of practices that you do day in and day out that help you recruit, that help you retain, that help you, you know, help people make decisions when you're not in the room. I think they need to give themselves the extra degree of difficulty to, you know, continue striving to get diversity, you know, not just gender and racial diversity, but diversity of points of view. You know, as much as possible.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The PayPal model is not good for anyone. Like that's widely taken out of context and, you know, poor Max, I guess, Max Levchin, whatever. Anyway, whoever made the disastrous quote about hiring all the same people, you know, that was taken out of context and I feel bad that they're getting piled on, although I guess they're billionaires, so they probably don't care. It worked. You know, but that is the easy way to do it. And so I guess, you know, don't do that if you can avoid it. There are things that are more important than being immediately successful and having an easy time of managing your staff. And one of those things is diversity. So career pathing. I guess the biggest thing I've got to say about that is maybe obvious, certainly will be obvious to you, maybe obvious to everyone. Management is not a promotion. Management is a separate career path.
Right. It's sort of a lateral to a different ladder. There's two ladders, right?
100%. No, 100%. The very first career ladder I made at the services company where I was the CTO the first time. And it was one of my first forays into doing things the way I thought they should be done, you know, trying to learn of all companies, trying to learn from IBM, you know. And so I had a whole ladder with, I still got it in a notebook somewhere on paper. I've long since lost the computer file, but it was a member of technical staff. And like at member of technical staff level four, I made a management line that was parallel, but you had to move over to it. Mm-hmm. You know, and we were big enough that that was a real thing. We had two or three people who made that move because they wanted to. But the thing I realized early on is that I was not the one ever who should be plucking people into management. I just don't believe, I don't believe in it. You know, it doesn't mean that you hold back. If you see somebody has a talent for interpersonal and a talent for the big picture and all that, you know, you tell them that, share that with them, tell them that's an important management skill. But, you know, telling them, you know what, you've been so good at this job and you've got all these other skills, I'm going to make you a manager. I think that actually is a bad thing. You know, as good as it feels in the short term.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've seen it fail more times than I've seen it succeed, where that exact thing happens. And it's like, and it's not just because you're being made to do it. People are like, yeah, cool, I'll try that out. And the reality is that, as you know, I mean, computers are very much predictable mm-hmm. things. They're very linear. Like, you do this, that's going to happen. And actually, we love that as engineers, because it's actually an easy job when you think about it. People are exactly the opposite. And it's an entirely different set of skills you need to grow or maintain as you grow as a manager to be able to deal with that. And it's a lot of people don't make that jump really quickly. I used to sort of relate being an earlier stage, you know, a CTO in an early stage company as being in the quantum superposition of both of those things, mm-hmm. right? Like over here, I'm doing some R&D, but I got to go jump on a call and interview some talent and have a one-on-one. And while that works in the earlier stages, I mean, it doesn't scale very well. But nonetheless, people have a little mixture of these things, you know, inside of themselves, which is why some people have made that successful jump. I think personally, just like, you know, needing to wear reader glasses now and like having, you know, wrist troubles and stuff. It's painful to realize I just can't keep hacking 18 hours a day like I used to. And it's a forcing function, unfortunately, as well. But yeah, you know, there's these two ladders, and, you know, you can ideally, you know, transition between them. I think one, well, has that, do you have any success stories? Let me start from there. Or any fail stories, either way, really.
I mean, sure. I've always, because I had the great good luck of recognizing early on that I needed to think about them as two separate things instead of a continuum. I also have always tried to create a role that sits in the middle of the two, like one foot on each ladder, everywhere I've been. And early on, I was doing it by accident. And then at some point, I realized I was doing it. And then shortly after that, I realized why I was doing it. And then it was just a thing that I did, you know? It's like, I often don't know, I often have no idea what I'm thinking until I hear myself say it. It was one of those situations.
Yeah.
And so I was observing myself and I was like, that's an odd thing. But I realized I was giving them a foot on each ladder. And so now in Vinyl, we've got people who are team leads. And
yep.
They write code every day, you know, they review pull requests, but they're sitting in kind of the senior seat, you know, the coxswain or whatever it is, coxswain. I don't even know how to pronounce that word. They're calling the cadence for all the rowers, right? But they're also a rower themselves. So I guess it's not exactly like that.
sure.
The metaphor works. So some of those people graduate, and by graduate I mean they either say this management stuff is not for me, I'm going to dig in and I'm going to go more on a senior hardcore technical, you know, senior technical position, you know, whether that's architect or strictly technology leader with no personnel responsibilities or whatever that is, right? Or they say, you know what, I can get more leverage out of, I can program bigger systems by programming people than I can by programming computers, right? And those people, you know, they go on to become VPs of engineering, you know, directors at larger companies, and graduate into the executive ranks. And I've had three or four that have moved through that. You know, I've probably also had two or three that have tried to move through that and retreated back to technology. I had one, you know, one of the most talented people I've ever worked with who excelled at the technology piece, just the straight technology piece, was, you know, I'd have him back to architect systems today. And he excelled at the management piece. He was really good at it. He cared about his people. And, you know, he was always able to put aside his ego, ask for the help he needed. And that meant he could ask them for the, you know, for what he needed from them for performance wise, and just really terrific all around in that respect. And he left the industry completely. He became a baker. He didn't want to do it anymore. And he's happy as a clam.
That's great. It's like that movie Office Space where he goes into construction and, yeah. Or destruction, actually, I think it is.
Yep.
Cool.
Exactly.
Okay. So what do you do when you have, you know, someone who's kind of stuck in a rut? Maybe they're, as much as we have enrichment and so forth, like, how do you break the Groundhog Day syndrome for folks that maybe are still, you know, not just in terms of growth or their actual chops or whatever, but like just in the longer arc, like, have you experimented around with how to move people around into different roles to solve that, or, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I would say definitely experimented with. It's a hard problem because there are certainly places where burnout is inherent. You know, game development springs to mind.
Right.
And for whatever reason, that's just the way game development is. Certain product organizations, you know, you hear about as repeat offenders, you know, promising dates they can't possibly deliver and then trying to kill their engineers to meet them.
Right.
But I have been, you know, incredibly fortunate / crafty never to have created such an environment. And the very few times I've found myself in such an environment, I have mostly handled it by simply counseling. I mean, it wasn't my thing, right? I wasn't emotionally involved with the thing I was doing for the most part, even when I had equity, because the people were more important to me. And so I would just tell them that they should probably think about leaving, you know, and we'd meet up down the road. You know, stay as long as you want. Of course, I want you. I don't want you to go anywhere. But this also doesn't seem good for you, and I can't do anything about it. You know, the place where I got fired for looking out for my people, I had that conversation more than once, and some of them stayed, you know, and didn't burn out, you know, didn't have a bunch of the bad effects. You know, they didn't love it, they didn't hate it, but they didn't, you know, have any spectacular flame outs or bad health issues or all the things that come along with that, right? And some of them went. You know, and some of the ones that went, I've connected up with further down the road. I will say that client work is tough, you know, but bringing this back to where I am now, client work can be tough because clients are tough.
Yep.
You know, they're paying you money. They want their thing, whatever the thing is.
Yeah. And it's inherently a little bit more waterfall, like a game launch or a rocket launch or whatever it's going to be, you know?
Yeah. 100%. And so, the thing that I try to do, you know, I guess we're going to use animal analogies today, but I have cats. And, you know, cats do what cats want to do. I don't know if you have a lot of experience with felines, but they really are very independent creatures in a lot of ways. And so, you know, when you've got a cat that's scared, all you can really do is like clear a path so that it can escape and then like let it escape. And so I try to do the same thing. You know, I don't try and solve when somebody's in a stressful situation, I don't try and solve the problems for them. You know, I don't go, just like I don't make them a manager if they haven't come to me and, you know, asked for it. I don't force them to change projects, because personal choice, in my view, in my experience, is one of the most important factors that contributes to feeling like you're in control of your life, even when you're absolutely not. Like, I mean, are any of us, honestly,
but you know what I mean, right?
Absolutely.
You feel like you are if you have that personal choice. And so, you know, I leave a door open. I leave a window open, you know, again, metaphorically speaking. And sometimes that's enough. You know, sometimes that just keeps the burnout and stress at bay because they know they have a choice, you know. And the choice they make as often as not is, you know, I'm not going to put Eric in the situation where he has to figure out a replacement for me. And honestly, this is not so bad. And if it is bad, I can leave. You know, I can go to this other project. Eric said so. And that works really well.
Yeah, that's a common theme going back to animals in training animals. My wife's been into training horses, and I've observed a lot of the videos and things. And it's all about releasing pressure. You know, you elicit a little teeny bit of performance, and then boom, you release the pressure immediately.
100%.
You know.
Yeah, another book. Maybe this will turn into a book podcast. But Kicked, Bitten, and Scratched is a terrifically good book.
All right. Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, now it's time for the wild card round. I really love wild card questions.
Excellent.
And so, and this time around, it's tangential. Well, it's a little bit tangential, but it's all about talent. Okay, so I want to know from both sides of the table. You know, I'm looking for worse interview situations. So, both from the candidate side of the table, and then maybe if you have one from the interviewer side of the table, like what are some poor candidate experiences you've been through?
Sure. So I'll preface this by saying that the ones that I would most love to tell you about, I absolutely cannot.
I can respect that.
For a legal reason.
Must be good.
Yeah, no, they're juicy. I can tell you off the mic.
We'll get a beer sometime.
Yeah, for sure. My favorite story in recent memory, we were interviewing for, actually it doesn't even matter what we're interviewing for. We're interviewing engineers. And we had a bunch of different kind of culture fit, you know, thinking on your feet, norming questions, like not like technical questions, but just like, how is this person going to be to work with kinds of questions. And one of those questions on our list was, you know, tell us about a time when you introduce a serious bug into production. How did you deal with that? And how did you participate in remediating it? And you know, over the few weeks we were interviewing for this particular role, we got lots of different answers to that question when we used it. But this one fellow just sat there for 10 or 15 seconds, which, you know, I'm sure you know that's like an interminable amount of time when you're waiting for somebody to talk. And he just looked us dead in the eye and he said, you know, honestly, I prefer not to write bugs in the first place.
I'll wait till we go off the record, but I feel like I interviewed that person too. it's a small world.
I mean, yeah, no, you would have been proud. I mean, we just like looked at him across the table and we said, you know what, that is an admirable stance. And we finished up the interview pretty quickly and he got the polite rejection letter. But it was just super interesting. I got a second hand story from one of my people. He was being interviewed for a just straight up mid-level engineering interview early on in his career. And the interviewer asked him, you know, what design pattern was his favorite? Which seems like a perfectly inoffensive question, you know, great. And this fellow, who's a terrific engineer, he's one of our senior people. He's a great leader, but he's just bad with names. And honestly, you know, what they're called in the Gang of Four books is different than what they're called in, you know, this PHP framework or that, you know, that C++ framework, right? They're
sure.
They all have, right? And so he tried to describe his favorite pattern, and the interview didn't like it. And
and said, you know, not even really paraphrasing, I think this is pretty much a quote. He said, if you don't know the name of the pattern, you don't even deserve to work here. And into the interview.
Oh my gosh. Well, so that's a faux pas on the side of the interviewer, in my opinion.
Oh yeah, 100%.
I won't get into mine right now, but I have similar nightmare stories of people throwing puzzles on you, stuff that they've been able to think about for months on end, and they want to see if you have an epiphany. And it's like, that's not how we work at all. We have, you know, it takes us sometimes weeks and months to figure out the hardest bugs in our lives. I mean, so that's the, yeah, I mean, and that's why people hate HackerRank. If you're more senior and stuff, it's like, just peer program with me, or let's just whiteboard or something. You know,
100%. Just show me how you think. I guess the last one I'll share with you, I just realized I do have one employer side one that I can share with you because it's a story on me. It's like something I still feel bad about to this day. We had to let a guy go after we did an acquisition of a company. We had to let him go. And he was just in many respects terrible. He was terrible for team cohesiveness. He was, you know, he had a cowboy complex, a hero complex.
Yeah.
You know, he was not very nice to his female teammates, not harassing them or anything, you know, nothing actionable, just not very nice, not a very pleasant coworker. And so by the time we got to the part where we were terminating him, I was like really aggravated with this guy. And I honestly, the way we did it, the HR person came with and I would give my spiel and then I would hand it to her. You know, this is a big company, so we had a way to do this, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I had planned out exactly what I was going to say and I just froze in the moment. And I didn't tell him any of my speech. I said, we're letting you go today. Heather will talk to you about the details.
Oh man. Oh jeez.
It was brutal. And I still feel terrible about it. I mean, not because it wasn't the best thing for him and the best thing for the company, but I didn't give him any of the speech about that or tell him, you know, any of the things that he did good or just none of it. I was just like, you're gone.
Well, you know, we all have bad days, and especially in light of all the other things you've said, you know, I mean, it's, you know, it happens, you know, you spent a lot of time not doing that too. So
yeah, knock on wood. It only happened once and that'll be the last time. But it was mortifying. That was, you know, it's funny in retrospect, but I'm sure he did not think it was funny and probably still doesn't.
Yeah. So, well, maybe one more, we can toss this one out if we need to, but how about recruiters? Have you had the luxury or the anti-luxury of working with any recruiters? You got any horror stories? I got plenty, by the way, but.
Yeah, I mean, I've worked with a very few good recruiters.
Yeah.
And I'm not really talking about the executive recruiters of the world. You know, I'm talking about the people who recruit line employees.
Yeah.
Because the executive recruiters have their whole own set of issues.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a hard job. And it's unclear, you know, in 2019, how relevant it even is. Like, it used to be you had a network and you had a way to get to people and, you know, you'd maintain relationships because you weren't trying to hire 1,000 people, right? You were trying to hire 5 people.
Right.
So I think it's a hard job first, but I got to tell you, the work bridges and the job spring partners of the world do themselves absolutely no favors by like dialing for dollars, you know, representing themselves. Somebody the other day used my name to talk to somebody in my network, telling them I referred them.
Yep. This is similar to mine too. I have names for every little hack that they do. There's Naked Shorts one time they sent me someone, well, it was someone who didn't have my business yet, right? And they're trying to show me they got all the goods, and they send me a CV of somebody they don't know is one of my good friends. And right. I knew that if they had represented the company properly, which they're supposed to do, you know, I would have known, because they would have said, hey, wait, I know Dave. And they would have come straight to me if they were in the market. And that's right. My biggest gripe with most of this stuff is that if they don't have the bird in the hand, they're trying to make a two-sided marketplace with nothing on both sides. Hence, 100%. The naked short, right? There's front-running candidates where sometimes people get wind of someone being in market, and I get a CV from two different recruiters that I have on contract literally simultaneously. I've had to reconcile these things by looking at the timestamp within minutes, who posted it first, or having to go back to the candidate. Sorry, now I'm griping, but having to go back to the candidate and go, who is repping you, you know,
right,
et cetera. 100%. I mean, it goes down the list, but it's why I like to bring this up. Go ahead, sorry.
That's one of the reasons that I love Boise, Idaho, because so I was in Austin where you are now. You're experiencing a completely different Austin than I did. I was there in the late 80s and then again in the late 90s. And in the late 80s, Round Rock was still a separate city.
Right.
Hippie Hollow was still a place that was scandalous to go. And so that was right after the formation of the MCC and when the early tech employers were just starting to move in. And it was small, you know, it was intimate. And Boise is still like that. Boise is about to do what Austin did, and it's going to happen much faster because now everything is connected. You know, everybody's on 24/7 and everybody's got their Instagram cranking and their Twitter cranking and their LinkedIn cranking. And so Boise is going to pass through all the stages much quicker, but still the recruiter we use in Boise is terrific. Her company that she founded has relationships with these people. And so we get very few really crazy, you know, off the wall cases. Actually, we've gotten zero from her, but we get very few in general in Boise. But everywhere else, it's a mess. I mean, twice in the last couple of months, fortunately, I don't engage with many recruiters. So I didn't experience this, but I've been told by colleagues that they have had resumes given to them. They moved to the interview. And they eventually find out that these people are trying to arbitrage Indian resources for, you know, fake people.
Yep. I wrote a blog post on this, not in that context, but with coding schools. It's called The Toddlers Are Raising the Infants.
I saw that. I love that. I did not realize that was you.
Yeah, that was me a couple of years back, because what was happening was I would be interviewing, because we too never hired any juniors, but until we needed to really, really grow, until we had enough seniors to help sort of foster them. So Eventually when I started hiring juniors, I was starting to interview coding school people, and I started realizing there's like 10 or 15 people in the room listening to the interview. And, I'm interviewing the teacher, who's the most senior person that could possibly talk the talk. But then they mysteriously drop out of the candidacy, but then they want to swap in one of their students. And it happened a couple times within a week. And wow. I got pissed. And that's, you know, I almost wanted to retract that blog post because it kind of shits on coding schools. But to their credit, some of the best people at VideoAmp came, they were the one percenters or the one in 500 of their coding school. And now they're like tech leads and doing amazing stuff, talking about growth, you know. So,
but that's individual. And the thing is, that's individual accomplishment at a certain level, right? I mean, yes, they passed through a code school, but I think it has nothing to do with the code school. You just reminded me of one more story, if you have a second.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, pretty tied into the stuff we've just been talking about. But we were interviewing for a code school, from a code school. And we've been going back and forth about whether, you know, we should be entertaining. We're a reasonably big deal in Boise. That sounds like we're really full of ourselves. We are an outsized presence given our size in Boise, because we've taken a real interest in the community. We sponsor events and we do stuff, right?
Cool.
One of our partners sits on a bunch of different boards. And so we've really focused on Boise, I guess is my point, because we care about it a lot. And so this coding school has kind of been using our name in vain. And we've been trying to decide if we're okay with that. And so this person came to interview with us and we interviewed them. And then when we closed the loop and said we weren't going to be proceeding, he said, after that interview, I realized I was completely unprepared for this career. I'm thinking I'm going to go and do a different school. Which is weird because the person he interviewed with is, you know, just the kindest, most generous person you would ever meet. Right. So I know that it was not a bad interview experience. Like, and the candidate didn't say so. They just said, you know, the kinds of questions that were being asked made me realize that there were huge gaps in my knowledge. Like I couldn't answer them. And so that person, I think, is probably, you know, if they ever achieve launch, you know, I think they're going to go far because they realized they looked at the evidence, they realized they didn't know, and they tried to figure out a way to fix it, which I thought was cool. But it didn't speak well to code school.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot to be said for humility and self-awareness. This has been a great time, Eric. I really appreciate your time. What a great,
yeah, likewise.
You know, what a great set of topics we've been on. So thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, likewise. This has been great. I appreciate you having me on.